Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Susan Shirk, who's the director of the University of California's Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation and the Ho Mui Lam Professor of China and Pacific Relations at the School of International Relations and Pacific Studies at the University of California, San Diego. In the Clinton administration, she served as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of East Asia and Pacific Affairs, and her books include How China Opened the Door, China, Fragile Superpower, and her latest, Changing Media, Changing China. Welcome to Background Briefing, Susan Shirk.
Well, it's nice to be back with you.
And the New York Times has a front page story today that's kind of intriguing. It starts out by talking about a meeting that took place last October, a big banquet in Beijing's tallest skyscraper, attended by the son of Mao Zedong's immediate successor, the daughter of the country's number two military official, who's been in there for some time, 3 decades, and then the half-sister of China's president-in-waiting, and many more. So what are the princelings up to?
Well, there's a very lively debate underway in China now about its future, right on the eve of the leadership turnover at the 18th Party Congress, which is going to occur this fall. And the princelings, the so-called princelings, the sons and daughters of the leaders of the Chinese Revolution and high-level political leaders, are pretty worried about China's future. So they, along with other people who are not so privileged, are debating where should China go from here, whither China.
So what's the dynamics in this debate? The princelings clearly have a lot of privilege. I mean, that goes without saying. So it would seem that they're conflicted. On the one hand, they want to maintain their privileges, which indicate a enormous disparity in wealth in this emerging number two economy in the world. But on the other hand, is there some of them that have a conscience, some altruism perhaps? What's going on there?
Well, you're right that their wealth and their influence of them and their families is completely bound up with the survival of Chinese Communist Party rule. And the way it looks to them now, it looks pretty shaky. And I must say there are many Chinese friends and colleagues in the last 6 or 12 months who've just volunteered to me that they really are worried that the days of the CCP rule in China are numbered. So I think what they would like to see is they'd like to see more active efforts on the part of the next administration in China to introduce political reforms from above, because they worry that if there's no strengthening of the legal system or no way that private enterprise can compete with the state-owned enterprises and other problems in the economic system, that they're kind of reaching the end of the road for Communist Party rule, that there's a lot of social discontent. It's harder and harder to maintain unity among the leaders at the top. And, you know, they're worried that the whole house of cards could collapse. So then there's a debate over what to do about it. And I think most of the people who are quoted in this article are pro-reform people who'd like to see more active reforms be introduced.
Again, I'm speaking with Susan Shirk, who's the director of the University of California's Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation and was formerly the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of East Asian and Pacific Affairs. And her latest book is Changing Media, Changing China. Now, when Chinese officials tell you that they're worried about the party collapsing, I mean, that also, of course, is somewhat self-serving. Why is there an assumption that the collapse of the party would result in chaos? Because my understanding is that there's an internal struggling going on and has been for some time between the government and efforts to bring about civil society and a legal system. You have these two parallel governments, if you will, the Communist Party on the one hand and a nascent kind of Chinese government on the other. And if the corrupt one goes away, that doesn't mean that the embryonic one is not going to take its place.
Well, the problem is that the Hu Jintao, Wen Jiabao administration for the past 10 years has really not done anything very significant. That's an exaggeration. But basically, the efforts that had occurred before to try to strengthen civil society, to improve governance, to allow more of an opening to the media, for the media, and journalist oversight of government, legal system, build rule of law, it's all been stalled out. And what has happened instead is the vested interests, of the state-owned enterprises, the propaganda department, the internal security bureaucracies, they have basically been a roadblock, and they've convinced the leaders that any opening, any greater accountability or giving more voice to civil society, that once you go down that road, it's a slippery slope and you'll lose control over society.
But isn't it fair to say, Susan Shirk, that the party itself is often corrupt and capricious, and we just have witnessed the fall of Bo Jilai in a very spectacular fall of a Politburo member. Now, whether or not that's an indicator of things to come, I don't know. But
well, yeah, I think that shows a couple of things. One is it shows how it's increasingly difficult for the top leaders, these nine men in the Standing Committee of the Politburo in particular, to maintain a facade of unity. They're in competition with one another, yet they try to make it look to everyone outside as if they're in complete lockstep agreement on everything. The Bo Jilai case is an example of how one ambitious leader, by going public, can really threaten the whole system. So their problem is, how do you maintain this unity at the top and prevent people from going public, even though in this new media environment, it's just so easy for a leader to go public and try to build a public following. The other thing, of course, it shows is that corruption is very pervasive. Bo Jilai is not the only leader with problems in his family and with a lot of corruption, and everybody knows that. But again, how in this non-democratic, hierarchical, authoritarian system do you prevent corruption? How do you, if they go after one another for corrupt behavior, it becomes war of all against all, and again, it reveals the divisions at the top, which could be suicidal. So they're stuck because of the nature of their political institutions. There's no way to throw the rascals out through elections. The legal system is just a tool of the party. There's no independent legal system, so corruption gets worse and worse.
So how do you reconcile then the pervasive belief amongst most Chinese that the Communist Party of the People's Republic of China lifted hundreds of millions of citizens from poverty and created this huge urbanized middle class, and it's all around them. You just have to look at the skyline. But at the same time, this is the most, they even have a worse disparity of wealth than we do in the United States. Okay. And many people consider what we're going through here in the United States with the 1% versus the 99% a new gilded age. Apparently, it's even worse in China. So I don't know how you can reconcile those two facts.
I know. It sounds really contradictory, doesn't it? I think the explanation is that Deng Xiaoping, who was China's leader in the 1980s, boldly transformed China's economic system and liberated all of this entrepreneurial and creative energy of the Chinese people, lifted residence controls so that rural people could move to the cities, opened the economy to the world economy, invited in foreign investment. China took off in the most dramatic way, and it was largely by decentralization of power and incentives. But beginning in the late 90s, especially after 2000, you've really seen something of a reversal with the building up of the state sector, state-led growth. I mean, they haven't gone back to central planning, but they are favoring these big state-owned enterprises, which are monopolistic, and it's very hard for private businesses to get bank credit. The stimulus after the global financial crisis very much aggravated the problem because most of that huge stimulus went to the state sector. They stopped the progress that was being made to create an independent legal system. So things have, from the standpoint of these princelings who are worried about the future and a lot of other white-collar people in China, they really think that things have kind of gone backward. But that doesn't mean that Chinese society is seething with unrest. Most people are quite satisfied with the improvement in their living standards. You know, they're unhappy about corruption. They're unhappy about inequality. They'd like a little more voice. But it's not a revolutionary situation, in fact. But over time, it could become one.
Again, I'm speaking with Susan Shirk, the director of the University of California's Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation. She served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of East Asian and Pacific Affairs, and her latest book is Changing Media, Changing China. Now, the political successor to President Hu Jintao is Xi Jinping. Again, it's pretty opaque, isn't it? Nobody knows who this guy is and what makes him tick, but on the other hand, it usually doesn't matter, right?
Well, he definitely is holding his cards very close to his chest because he can only lose by making enemies or being too outspoken at this point because he is the anointed successor. If you say he doesn't matter that much because it's collective leadership, yes, to a certain extent that's true. He's only first among equals in this collective rule of the Standing Committee of the Politburo, but he is first. You know, he does have the authority, especially over personnel appointments. He certainly has the ability to shape the overall direction for China. If he wanted to take some bold initiatives, you know, he might, I don't know whether or not he'd be able to bring his colleagues on board. It really depends what's in their minds, and everybody's been quite cautious. But I think there's an opening. There's a possibility for some positive new initiatives in the next administration. And I want to mention one thing. I think the low-hanging fruit here is the legal system. I mean, strengthening the legal system, even if you don't do anything about elections, would mean a dramatic improvement in fairness and justice, and it would make the economy work better. And I was encouraged that the party leaders, when they brought down Bo Xilai, said, tried to make the best of it and said, look, this shows that we are a party ruled by law. No one, even very powerful leaders, are above the law. And I thought there was some hint that they might be moving in the direction of trying to strengthen the legal system.
So, well, just in closing, it's fair to say we've been largely talking about a top-down movement towards any possible reform as opposed to a bottom-up. So is that to say that the spirit of 1989, the Tiananmen, that's dead? There's no chance of a reform movement coming from the people?
Well, you know, we haven't talked yet about the microblogs and the Chinese Twitter called Weibo. There is a lot of discussion among ordinary people about all of these issues as well, quite open. I mean, the debate about China's future is much more open than we've ever seen it before, in large part because of these social media. But the ability to bring about change bottom-up in China in a society where you can still send the police to repress anyone who's seen to be creating an organized opposition, it's still pretty daunting. So there are protests about very local specific issues, but I think that if and when change comes in China, it's more likely to come from the top.
Well, just to go back though to the scandals that took down the Politburo member Bo Xilai, and what came out of that, you know, with the whole soap opera involving the British businessman who was murdered by Bo Xilai's wife, or on orders from him, and the idea of his corrupt friend, the police chief, and it's a window into this kind of unholy relationship between powerful politicians and powerful businessmen. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these businessmen have done well in China, have come from Taiwan. I'm just trying to get a sense of how that would compare, for example, to the way that Russia works under KGB Incorporated, the Putin regime, where Putin seems to regulate the capitalists. I don't know whether he shakes them down, but he certainly gives all of the big state enterprises to his cronies, and perhaps he's going to end up incredibly wealthy at the end of his tenure, which mercifully may end sooner than, at least according to my friends in Russia, who find the reversal of democracy frightening. Is there a comparison then between the way KGB Incorporated operates in Russia and the Communist Party of the People's Republic of China operates in terms of its relationship to the business titans?
I think there's some similarity, but there are also a lot of differences. China's, the firms in Russia are private firms. And they're private firms that are very dependent on the patronage of Putin and the central government. And if they challenge that, they're in trouble.
I'm afraid we've run out of time, but thank you very much for joining us here today, Susan Cheung.
Well, it's always good to talk with you. You're very knowledgeable, and it's a lot of fun.
Well, thank you, Susan.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Again, I've been speaking with Susan Cheung, the director of the University of California's Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation and the Ho Mui Lam Professor of China and Pacific Relations at the School of International Relations and Pacific Studies at the University of California, San Diego. In the Clinton administration, she served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of East Asia and Pacific Affairs, and her books include How China Opened Its Door, China, Fragile Superpower, and her latest, Changing Media, Changing China. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Brooke Peterson. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Standing along the side of the pickup truck, a shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right, another headline written down in a
fire.